Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. On this Thursday, January 28th, on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Erica Martin. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Park City. We are tracking some snow showers for today. Pull up your live cam over Main Street a couple of times. Looks so pretty. Mid-30s for your highs. Overnight lows in the 20s. We're tracking a trough for your Friday. So the good news is more snow showers in forecast. And it'll break by Saturday, second half of Saturday and Sunday. Plenty of sunshine. Now, your temps overnight on Friday into Saturday in the low 20s and upper 20s to low 30s on Saturday. I think you'll see right around 28, 29 degrees. And then we're going to see temperatures climb and climb. My pick of the week ahead, my pick of the weekend happens to be Sunday. It's going to be so pretty out there. Keep in mind for today, though, we do have windy conditions. The winds are going to diminish, but still a bit of an issue for the morning hours. And then beyond that, we're tracking a pretty nice Monday, meaning dry. And then, of course, we're going to track some more snow showers. It's peaks and valley type of flow right now, and so that's what we're going to deal with. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we could see some isolated snow showers. Looks like Tuesday and Wednesday look favorable. Temperatures at that point are going to be in the low to mid-30s, overnight lows in the teens, and then, it's going to be a lot colder on Wednesday, mid-20s.
Okay, Erica, thank you. And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Drew. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. We have a considerable danger accompanied by what we call a special avalanche bulletin for dangerous conditions in the backcountry at the mid and upper elevations of all aspects. We saw some natural avalanche activity yesterday, predominantly along the Park City ridgeline. One ripped out to the ground. This is South Monitor Bowl. That's backcountry terrain essentially between the Park City Mountain Resort and then the Canyons Resort as well, just south of the 9990 lift. Also, the Sound of Music was remotely triggered. This is also along the Park City ridgeline from the ridgeline above, and that looked to be about 2 to 2.5 feet deep, maybe 300 feet wide. Fairly complex pattern of snow and the snowpack structure overall, but the big picture is that we have seen very strong winds out of the southeast, the south, the southwest. The snowfall that we have seen has rising densities, which is also a red flag. So again, overall considerable the upper and mid elevations, natural human triggered avalanches. Likely, we're telling people to avoid being on or underneath steep mountain terrain for today.
Okay, Drew, thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright. Later on, the Director of Regional Planning with Mountain Land Association of Governments, Sean Seeger, talking about Wasatch County's interlocal meeting held last night when he presented on affordable housing. And finally, Sundance Film Festival programmer Charlie Sextro talking about this year's narrative feature film lineup. Earlier this week, a Democratic state representative launched an impeachment probe of Utah's attorney general. Both Summit and Wasatch County's representatives say they will not be supporting the legislation. KPCW's Jessica Lowell explains.
Representative Andrew Stoddard, a Democrat, opened a resolution to impeach Utah's Attorney General Sean Reyes due to Reyes's ties to a GOP organization that issued robocalls urging people to storm the U.S. Capitol building January 6th. In a press release, Stoddard said Reyes had, quote, violated his duty to the state as an attorney and public officer by putting the, quote, aims of special interest groups above the voters who elected him. The bill would open an investigation into any criminal misconduct. Wasatch County Republican Representative Kara Birkeland says based on what she knows about the bill, she will not vote in favor.
I have not read the resolution. I have no problem with, you know, him sharing his opinion. That was obviously something he's passionate about, and we just need to stick to the issue and vote and move on.
Republican Representative Mike Kohler serves Wasatch County as well as residents within the Park City municipal boundaries. He also says he does not support the impeachment but would like to know more about Reyes's activities.
I'm not really looking for something. If it's going to come out, let's learn about it. I think a lot of what happened at the Capitol is probably, my opinion is, it's been partisanly discussed, and I think the more open discussion we can have, the better. Certainly, we don't want to have that happen again. The causes need to be understood. And that said, again, at this point, I don't see Mr. Reyes having committed something that would cause me to vote for impeachment.
Stoddard says he opened the bill because he had limited other options to investigate Reyes' alleged offenses. One other way to investigate Reyes is through grandma requests. Berkland says she would have no issue with Stoddard taking this alternative.
I have no problem if anyone wants to, and anyone can, grandma request any records from any elected official. I have no problem with that. An investigation and an impeachment or anything that involves the legislature, I see no need for that at this time.
Reyes also joined 16 other state attorneys general in signing a Texas petition in December. The petition was to invalidate the 2020 election results in four different states. The appeal was later overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
And we should note that Kara Berkland actually represents Summit County residents in House District 53. Well, the Summit County Council met virtually yesterday and decided on their new Transit District board members and spent a few hours on the Dakota Pacific development at Kimball Junction. A lot to get through. On the phone with a recap, I have Council Member Glenn Wright. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with Dakota Pacific. We've got a new review schedule. Can you explain that?
Yes. What we did was we kind of consolidated all the remarks that the four council members had on what we think needs to happen if we're to approve Dakota Pacific. And now we'll have, we'll authorize the planning department and Dave Thomas to have specific discussions with Dakota Pacific to see if we can come to an agreement on some of those issues.
So how many subgroups do we have?
There's gonna be at least four subgroups. And we haven't decided which of the council members yet will sit on those subgroups. We'll decide that in the next week.
So the subgroups will include the applicant, a member of the county staff, and a council member?
Well, actually, the subgroups within Summit County will consist of two council members and county staff. County staff will then negotiate with Dakota Pacific for some legal reasons.
And how often are these subgroups going to meet?
I expect they'll probably meet about once a week, but we'll have to see how that develops.
All right, and then would report to the council then each meeting?
You'll report to the subgroup and then to the council, yes.
So will the two council members be different in each of the subgroups, or will there be some overlap?
It's possible. We see we have different interests in several of the categories of interest that we'll be talking to Dakota Pacific. For example, I'm particularly interested in sustainability. Doug, from a design standpoint, I think Melina and Roger are very concerned about affordable housing, as we all are, but those seem to be the peak interests of the four council members involved. So I expect we will involve everybody in these subgroups.
And Deputy County Attorney Jamie Bracken said she expects this to come back in about 6 weeks for approval. Is that realistic?
Well, to be determined. We'll see how the discussions go. You never can tell once you sit down and start negotiating.
All right. As we reported earlier this morning, it sounds like council members favor Council Member Chris Robinson coming back into the Dakota Review. Why do you favor that?
Yeah, I think it's a good, Chris has so much expertise in development that we really value his opinion on these issues. And he really got kind of booby-trapped on the recusal. He really didn't have to, and it actually cost him a fair amount of money to kind of pay for the tickets that were originally given to his kids. So, I think with anybody on the council, if you recuse yourself anytime a friend is even peripherally involved with something before the council, very few of us would vote on anything. So, we would really value Chris's service on this particular project going forward.
Yeah, but he recused himself. Why didn't he ask the county attorney in the first place? And then, now he's missed all of the discussions.
Yes, he has. But, the summary we have right now, I think, is a good starting point for him. Chris is just a really honest guy, and he felt that it was something that he should do at the time. He did it without really consulting the attorney's office.
All right. So does he have to go back now and listen to all of the missed discussions that he's not been part of? I mean, how does he know what you know?
I think it's up to him. I, I think more than likely he will just look at the summaries we have so far, see if he agrees with them, and move forward from there.
So is this really about just getting that third vote? Because it sounds like right now we've got two leaning in favor of this and two against it, and then he's going to make the tie vote?
I don't know if that's accurate, but no, it's not just to get a third vote. It's to bring his expertise into the – yeah, I would not particularly characterize a vote of the council at this particular moment.
All right. Concerning Councilmember Roger Armstrong's issue, do you think that the – application represents an increase in density or not?
No, I don't.
Okay, so that's not an issue then?
No, I don't believe so.
All right.
I mean, it certainly involves increase in the people that are living in that area, but that's not definition of density for that particular, for the original project. So, I think we have to base our opinions there, if it's increase in density, on legal opinions from county attorney staff.
You're just looking at square footage.
Yep. Exactly.
Okay. Let's see. So we've got, I think the density, let's talk just a little bit more about that. So we've got density in terms of people, a lot of people there all the time, or we've got people there during the day parts. Is that, how do you differentiate the density?
Strictly on a legal standpoint, it's square feet. But in terms of people, yeah, we'll have a lot. We'll actually have more people there on a daily basis with the old plan. I would think there would be more employees in those office buildings, and more, just thousands of more inbound commuters every day. And yes, we will certainly have more people living there permanently. From a traffic standpoint, that tends to spread the traffic out more evenly over the course of the day. And if we get the housing agreements right, and we can fill a lot of the affordable housing with a lot of resort workers, they will have access to walking access to public transportation. That should mitigate a lot of the traffic problems that would come from the increased number of people there. This is all speculative, though. Well,
it's all right.
We're guessing. We're guessing that's what's going to happen. Do any of us absolutely know the answer? I think that would be presumptive of anybody to say that they know absolutely what's going to happen.
Yeah. We know it's already a little bit of snow on the roads can just really create gridlock. But
I think one of the big issues there is what happens with UDOT and Route 224.
And that's
224-80 interchange. And I think that is really critical to making the project work.
And that's right where I'm leading into. The Kimball Junction Area Plan Survey has a deadline for this Sunday. Honestly, I have not seen a lot of the county is pretty good about putting out messaging, and I have not seen anything about this. Have you taken the survey?
I have. After the presentation, Caroline sent it to all of the council members, and I'll be quite up front with everybody on it. I think alternate three there is the only viable option, and I would like to modify it further, as I stated during my questions to UDOT during that presentation. I don't think the other three really help us at all.
They, as you log on to the survey, and we'll put that on our website here a little bit later on, but, they say, it'll take 10 minutes. I mean, honestly, to really understand what they're talking about, it's going to take a lot longer than that. And people are asking, why hasn't the county offered a few public information Zoom sub-meetings outside of a council meeting? I mean, so that people can understand what is being proposed.
Yeah, actually, I can't answer that. I don't know why we haven't. That probably would have been a good idea.
So should we extend the survey, given that a lot of people don't know about it?
Well, I believe it's a UDOT survey, so I'm not sure how much we can extend it. We'll have to check with that. I actually have a Zoom meeting with Caroline, if I look at my calendar, either today or tomorrow, and I'll explore that with her.
So who tapped UDOT to conduct the survey? I mean,
Well, it's their project. It's really up to them to gather information.
All right. Well, as
it's
you
not
know,
a county project. It's a UDOT project, and the county is cooperating with them. But strictly speaking, it's a UDOT project.
All right. Well, there's been a lot of loud outcry about alternative two. This would be the High Ute encroachment alternative. Should we just knock this one out of contention, since it's the one that no one seems to want?
I certainly would. I think it's an awful option. And I think realistically, getting community input on this is important. But the county is going to have to come up with some money for this project. So ultimately, the five council members are going to have a very heavy vote in which one of these options, you know, we pick, I believe. Yeah, I'm not that up to date on on working with UDOT, but that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah, and I guess I haven't heard any council members say to UDOT, even contemplating running a road through protected open space is a huge abuse of taxpayer monies that were used to secure it as open space.
Yeah. I think we can put that one to bed. As far as I'm concerned, I will absolutely not support that one.
Okay, and you feel yet your fellow council members feel the same way?
I believe they do.
We should note that the encroachment on the High Ute Ranch isn't even listed as a limitation to the alternative, and that just seems to me not very transparent on UDOT's part. But
yeah, we heard from Utah Opens Land about 30 seconds after that proposal came out.
All right. Let's move on to some of the legislative update. You and Melina Stevens are the two liaisons to the legislature this year. House Bill 115 is the bill on annexation across county lines. Do we know which way this is going for Summit County?
We don't know yet, but we think we're making some good progress. We'll just have to monitor it and monitor it, you know, right up to the last vote on the House or Senate floor, if we remember what happened last year. But I think, you know, we have some really, really good land use attorneys working for the county. Dave Thomas and Jamie Bracken are the top public land use attorneys in the state. And they dove right into that and have given some recommendations that UEC is backing us on. And so we'll see what happens. You never can tell what's going to happen with the legislature, though, so. Like I said, we'll be monitoring that very closely until the last vote is in.
House Bill 82 could quash the county's ability to regulate accessory dwellings. In a brief conversation yesterday, you wondered if you can get help from the legislature on this. And it sounds like, really, I mean, but the majority of lawmakers don't have a problem with letting people do what they want with their property.
A good portion of the legislature comes from the development industry and the home building industry. So that's what we're dealing with in the legislature. But they do listen to voices of the public if the public gets loud enough. So that's about where we have to go on that.
You also commented briefly on a bill that would allow counties 4th through 6th class to use some of their transient room tax money to mitigate tourism impact. Summit County is 3rd class, so not part of this. But it sounds like you would like to be part of this, but there were reports that the Park City business community doesn't support the proposal. So what do you know there?
Yeah, and what I actually said is I think we need to talk to the chamber about that. Because I know other class 3 counties would like to be involved in that. And I would hate if it's not really that important anymore for Summit County to be an obstacle to the other class 3 counties. I think there are 3 other class 3 counties. One of them spoke up vocally on the UAC meeting, the commissioner from Box Elder County, who is also the president of UAC this year.
Yeah.
So I would certainly like to help them if we can. But, you know, we need to have some discussions with the chamber about that before we can do anything. But we're all in partnership.
For the transit board appointments, the council appointed former county council member Kim Carson and Joe Spink. Kim, we know about. What can you tell us about Joe?
Uh, We actually had an amazingly well-qualified group of people that we interviewed. We interviewed 8 people for the spot. We thought Joe was really particularly qualified. He's a engineer who is a civil engineer who has built helped build transit systems in various parts of the country. We just thought he would bring some crucial expertise to the transit board.
So do you have anybody?
But we really had a lot of very well-qualified people, both from people who are extensive users of the system right now to one person who's retired and was on the board of, I think the board of supervisors in the Bay Area and was one of, participant in the BART system.
And that's where
we had some very well qualified people.
And it's one thing to design transit systems. It's another one for the person to be standing out right now in the snow waiting for transit to show up. So do we have anybody who has that real life experience about what it's like to ride a bus?
Oh, yeah, I believe Spinks does because he came from a transit oriented area. I would say for the 5 people that are on there now, the 3 council members that we appointed, Roger has some experience riding the bus.
Yeah, we know Roger's experience. I don't think he's done it since. But so you think you have a well-rounded board there, or is it just, people, like I say, who design transit?
Yeah, I think it's a good start. We'll have to see how it proceeds.
All right. Finally, wanted to just touch on the fact that the council did renew the contract for Tom Fisher for another 3 years. We heard from County Attorney Dave Thomas that Tom received an increase in his base salary. How much are we talking about?
It went up to $175,000 a year. But I want to put that in context. He actually received that most of that last year. And then when we hit the COVID crisis and our economy crashed and tax income crashed, Tom voluntarily gave up his raise last year. So it's a pretty microscopic raise over what he would have had last year.
Okay. So it sounds like that was restored and then basically just put into his retirement account?
Yep, correct.
Any other changes to his benefits?
The one other change was he asked he doesn't take much vacation. He works 24/7 for the county, and he asked if he could he didn't take some vacation. He's up to his total near his total accruement of vacation days every year. If he could get paid for unused vacation days up to 2 weeks of vacation, up to 2 weeks of work every year, so we acceded to that request.
Oh, thank goodness. But he should take the vacation time.
He should. Yes, absolutely. But especially this last year has been a really high-stress year on everybody in the county staff. And Tom has really done a magnificent job in leading the staff through that.
Okay. Glenn, I need to leave it there. Thanks for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
That's Summit County Council Member Glenn Wright. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. We've got Sean Seeger from Mount Land Association of Government up next. Wasatch County elected bodies held an interlocal meeting last night. One of the presenters was the Mountain Land Association of Government's Regional Director of Planning, Sean Seeger. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. How are you guys?
I'm well. Thank you. So you presented a list of recommendations from Mountain Lands and discussed about 7 or 8 areas for the municipalities and county governments to take into consideration. You talked about establishing a housing authority. Doesn't Wasatch County already have one, or this would be a regional housing authority?
Yes, Wasatch County has a housing authority in place right now. They've been operating for about 10 years or so. Been building a couple of really nice projects and helping people out with rental assistance and taking second positions on mortgages and such. And what we were talking about last night is reorganizing the existing housing authority.
So to include all of those other entities?
Yes, the reorganization would be more inclusive of all the local governments in Wasatch County. and play a little bit of a different role than what they've played in the past. You know, be a little bit more creative about how they're leveraging some of the local funds and kind of taking on a new role in the community and reestablishing itself, taking a look at their vision, mission, goals, objectives, kind of resetting all that, all those expectations of the Housing Authority in the current environment that we find ourselves in. I don't know if you want me to get into any of the numbers.
Yeah, before we do there, though, you had also mentioned hiring a professional staff to do what exactly for this Housing Authority?
That's right. Right now, the Housing Authority is staffed by an accounting firm that basically processes payments and does a really good job of accounting for the numbers, but we don't have any professional staff that go out and seek partnerships or seek developers to come in and use federal tax credits to help leverage some of our funds. And so that could be one of the key roles that a senior level professional staff person could play in Wasatch County.
All right. Let's move to the numbers then. I mean, how much affordable housing is needed in Wasatch County?
Oh, my heavens. You know, I described last night that I feel like I'm Chicken Little, explaining that the sky is falling on some of these numbers. But the studies that we were referencing last night is a study done by James Wood from the University of Utah. He did a regional housing needs assessment for both Summit and Wasatch County. And Jim Wood came up with some numbers that are pretty shocking. And I'll just read a couple of them to you here. He said that in the Summit County area, I'm going to cite both Summit and Wasatch since I have both those available to me. In the Summit area, we have a need for 198 owner-occupied units per year to be constructed. And we have 141 units needed in Wasatch County, owner-occupied, per year. And in the rental market, in Summit County, we need to be building 231 units per year and 102 units per year in Wasatch County. We're not doing anything. We're doing maybe 1% of that, 2% of that. Park City has a more aggressive effort than Wasatch County does at this point. But we're way behind in affordable housing. Anyone that has ever known anyone that's trying to look for housing in Summit or Wasatch County knows what can relate to these numbers that I'm citing.
Yeah, so are we talking affordable or attainable housing? As you know, those are very different things.
Yes, in Wasatch County, we've been talking about attainable housing. You know, and you can get into some of the income numbers if you want as well, but what the policymakers in Wasatch County are interested in is attainable housing and making sure that their own workforce can find a place to live in Wasatch County. In fact, the school superintendent Sweat last night described the efforts that his staff are going through. I think he cited the number of 60 employees per year turnover. And a lot of that turnover is due to the fact that the new teachers that are coming into the system cannot find a place to live in Wasatch County. And so they find a little bit better offer down in the metro area, down in Salt Lake or Utah County, and they migrate to jobs that are down in the metro area rather than stay with their stay up in Wasatch County.
Yeah. You had mentioned that for every 100 market rate homes, 107 affordable units are needed. Well, we know that's not going to happen because the entities are only requiring between, 10 and 20% for every housing development that part of that be affordable, that percentage be affordable.
I'm glad you brought that up. I misspoke last night on that number as I re-looked at it. I made a mistake in the way that I presented that data. What I was trying to communicate is that every time we build 100 market rate units in the town of Midway, for example, that creates the need for 49 employees. So 100 new housing units at market rate creates the need for another 49 employees in Wasatch County somewhere. Those are schools, school teachers, policemen, people that mow our lawns and take care of our water and our power and everything in between. And so I cited households. I was trying to reference employees, and I did it by adding up the three entities together, Heber, Midway, and unincorporated Wasatch County. I made a mistake doing that, so I apologize.
Okay, so that makes sense. So 100 market homes, 49 employees. Still, we've heard for years, I mean, growth does not pay its own way. So, I mean, the only way to stop this train is to slow down growth. I mean, we're not talking about that because we have so many vested development rights. So
I agree with you that it's going to be very difficult to slow down growth. In fact, today I think we have in Wasatch County 35,000 people that live there. By the year 2050, we project that to go from 35 to about 69,000. Summit County, we have about 42,000 people living in Summit County today. We project that to go up to 63,000 in the year 2050. So growth is coming. We need to do something dramatic to try to find places for our own children and grandchildren and our own city and community staff to live.
Right. So, I mean, so what are some of those suggestions then? Again, because we don't have the private development community jumping up to say, I'll build affordable housing, even though it's most needed, because there's just not the money to make doing that.
Yep, I agree. And I one of the recommendations that we made to the interlocal group last night was to follow kind of what Park City is considering, where the local governments basically build some of the rental units, and they use the rent from those rental units to retire the debt. So you start to get into the landlord business and use that rent income to retire that debt. So that's one of the ways that the local governments can start to play a role in terms of creating affordable housing.
Right, but they're pretty resistant to going into the property management business, aren't they?
I think so, and it's a difficult topic. Affordable housing is such a difficult topic to start to talk about and then to do something about, and the market is very complicated, and we've been dealing with this for 10, 20 years, as we all know, and it's not going to get any better, so it's time for some dramatic moves on the part of the local government.
Okay, so what's next, do you think?
You know, I think the next thing for Wasatch County to consider is that list of recommendations that we made last night: reorganize the housing authority, hire a full-time senior-level staff person, almost like a planning director, leverage those local funds with state, federal funds, and even some tax financing mechanisms, bond and build their own housing, require land from new annexations. That's a big thing that is very important, is to try to get free land when we're doing these things. And let's not give our dollars away through rental assistance and housing assistance. Let's try to take our dollars and leverage those into new rentals. Require affordable housing as part of any new development that's approved in Wasatch County. And then hopefully we can consider some new sources of revenue, like maybe some car rental tax increase statewide for affordable housing, or maybe a real estate transfer fee or something like that. We could try to encourage our legislators to consider.
We've tried for 40 years about that real estate transfer tax, but
yeah, maybe just on the luxury homes, you know, over $1 million or something like that, to try to make it a little bit easier to do.
Yeah. So your recommendations, do they exist somewhere that people can have a look at?
Yes, we distributed the presentation last night to all of the members on the interlocal. I can send you a copy as well. We can put it on our website at mountainland.org and make that available to the public as well.
Okay. And then also the Wasatch Back 2050 study, there's also apparently a link for that people can get more information about, really.
Yeah.
Just the impact that we're going to see in growth in the next 20
That's right.
plus years.
Yeah, we call this the Wasatch Back Choice for 2050. And what that is simply sewing all the general plans together of Heber City, Midway, Camas, Oakley, Park City, Snyderville Basin, sewing those together and being able to visualize what that growth is going to look like in the form of a map. So we've been doing that for the past couple weeks. We had one of these for the Wasatch Choice for 2040 map that we that existed about 5 or 10 years ago, and we're going to update that to the 2050 edition.
Okay. Sean, anything else you'd like to add before I let you go?
Nope. If anyone has any questions, please get a hold of me at mountainland.org. Love to talk to you.
Okay. Sean Seeger, again, is the Director of Regional Planning for Mountain Lands Association of Government. Thanks for your time. Well, a group of 17 dogs are training for serious work at Park City Mountain Resort and Deer Valley Resort this week. KPCW's Jessica Lowell explains what the furry friends are doing on the mountain.
As part of the Wasatch Backcountry Rescue School, the 17 dogs are training for search and rescue with an emphasis on avalanche recovery. The four-day program takes place at both Park City Mountain and Deer Valley Resorts. This year is an in-house training, but on alternating years, they offer in international schools with dogs coming in from as far away as Poland. Andy Von Houten is the avalanche dog handler at Park City Mountain Resort. He says search and rescue dogs love the job they have.
The windy, cold, snowy blizzard days, that's when, you know, that's what they love. They love sitting outside in that weather. And this is all they know from 7 weeks old till, you know, whenever we retire them. This is everything they do. You know, even in the summer, it's focused on training and obedience to make them better in the winter. And so, yeah, to the dogs, this is the greatest job I think a dog could ever have, to be honest with you.
He says at Park City Mountain, they have about 45 to 50 dogs, most of which are golden retrievers and Labradors that range in age from 10 weeks old to 10 years old. He says the type of training dogs receive depends on where the dogs are in their careers. When training, dogs are broken up into three groups: puppies, intermediate, and advanced. He says they try to make sure puppies are comfortable on the mountain, and they also focus on obedience training. As dogs continue through their career, they'll start to learn more advanced techniques like tug-of-war.
We try to make this as fun as we can, and to most of these dogs, it's just a game of tug-of-war. And they know if they find somebody in the snowpack, they get to play tug-of-war with that person. Through the training, obviously, in a real situation, that's not going to happen. But to them, they know if they find something in the snow, they get to play tug-of-war.
He says the benefit of using dogs is that they work faster than humans.
The dogs in that regard are worth about 400 people, just in terms of terrain they can cover and how fast they can cover it. Watching these dogs work is nothing short of amazing.
Another part of WBR's training includes medical call-outs. Dogs will get sent out to help skiers in the backcountry who have been injured. Van Houten says they've also started to expand rescue missions beyond the winter months.
It is something to be seen how fast these dogs can move on avalanche debris. We've started to use them more in the summer for missing hikers. A couple years ago, a bunch of our teams got deployed down to Colorado City for the flash floods when we had some folks missing. So we're starting to utilize the dogs more year-round versus just in the winter. But right now, our primary focus is still avalanche rescue and recovery.
If you see a dog on the mountain, he says they're friendly and enjoy the attention.
We encourage a lot of social interaction with our dogs. It's a big part of what we do. We've got our dogs up on the hill. You know, if we had a bunch of 100-pound German Shepherds that were snarly, you know, like police dogs, it wouldn't go well. So we actually really enjoy it when we get a chance to have guests come up and interact with our dogs.
He says just make sure to ask to pet the dogs and take off your skis because they can get hurt on the edges. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, the Sundance Film Festival kicks off tonight, featuring a number of opening day films and an opening night welcome from the new film festival director, Tabitha Jackson. On the phone with a look at this year's dramatic program, I have Sundance programmer Charlie Sextro. Good morning, Charlie.
Hey, Leslie. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, so let's see. We are still holding this year a U.S. and world dramatic competition?
Oh, yeah. We have all four of our competitions. So, we have all our competitions that we've had in previous years. They're a little bit, they've been cut down a little bit. Each one of them have 10 films compared to normal years when they have 12 or 16.
Yeah. Okay. So how would you describe this year's festival? I mean, any sort of a theme to the films that were included in the competition?
You know, I think in the competitions, I would not say set themes because, you know, we had the normal amount of submissions that we do any year. We just decided early on that we were going to play less films. So it just became so much more competitive compared to normal years. So I would actually say every film and the sections are completely different from every other film. There's not a lot of crossover. So I really feel like it's just a really kind of a kind of grab bag of kind of exciting work this year.
Yeah, I'm always was amazed by how many films you had to look at before you pared it down, and that had to be even tougher this year, huh?
Yeah, like I was saying, we had made a decision just operationally back early in the summer, the number of films. And we assumed that there would be less submissions, and so that was a part of it. So we typically play around 120 films, and this year we're only playing a little, I think it's 72, just over 70. We made that decision early, again, assuming there would be less, and then come October when our submissions closed, we realized that our submissions were just about the same. So international cinema, exactly the same as previous years, slightly down on U.S. So then it was just like, oh, we thought we were going to see less. And then we're like, oh, no, we saw the same. So it was like really, really difficult decisions. And we knew we were going to be letting go films that we would have played in previous years. But that means the films that we are playing, it's just really, really, really strong quality.
All right. Well, let's talk about then some of those in the U.S. competition films now. I mean,
yeah, I could talk about even two, like tonight. So we kind of have a kickoff of films from each of the sections that are kind of kicking off tonight for the opening day. So our U.S. dramatic competition film is Coda. So, you know, Sundance, always everyone's always looking for what's that big, like, crowd-pleasing film, like, charming, lovely, like, funny, hilarious film, and it's called CODA. And this is, CODA stands for Child of Deaf Adults. And so it is about a young woman in high school who dreams of singing, but her family are a fishing family off the coast of Massachusetts, and her mother, father, and brother are all deaf. Mother is played by Marley Matlin. The father and brother are also deaf actors as well. And it is the most lovely, fun, beautiful, tear-jerking, just like lovely experience of just this family and about her trying to find her way in life while also like being there for her family. So it is a big, big crowd pleaser.
Okay. And then some of the other ones showing tonight?
Showing tonight, yeah. So I would say in our U.S. documentary competition, we have another incredible film that I think is going to be a big one that people are going to be talking about all year. It's called Summer of Soul. And this is the directorial debut of Questlove, who many people know from The Roots, from they're the house band of the Tonight Show. And so Questlove is basically an encyclopedic brain of music culture. And so what this is about, in 1969, there was the Harlem Cultural Festival. This is a massive festival that took place in Harlem. 400,000 people that same summer attended Woodstock. 300,000 people attended the Harlem Cultural Festival, which was set up to be this showcase of the excellence of African-American culture in the U.S. But it is basically something that is not discussed, not really known in culture as a whole compared to Woodstock. Everyone knows everything about Woodstock. Nina Simone played there, B.B. King played there, Sly and the Family Stone, Gladys Knight, Stevie Wonder, Fifth Dimension. Everyone played there. And in Questlove, it's not only you get to see the footage from the time, which has basically not been seen. And what he's doing is revealing that this kind of lost part of culture, he's sharing it for the first time and contextualizing it. It is an incredible, incredible watch that is so smart and so just like beautiful. I think it's going to be a big one. Awards, everything for the rest of the year.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the others that kind of stood out for you.
Yeah. And then another one too that I think is a really interesting Sundance connection is this filmmaker. It's called, or the film is called In the Same Breath. So this filmmaker, Nanfu Wang, who's a Chinese born filmmaker based in the U.S. now. She won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance 2 years ago with her film One Child Nation. And then last year, she was at Sundance on the as a jury member. After she left Sundance, she went back. So, you know, we're talking, you know, early February last year, she flew back to China. And she, over the course of the year, dealing with COVID and everything, she was has done this incredible kind of personal, big scope documentary looking at China and the U.S. and their responses to COVID. and kind of the similarities and differences going on. And she's doing it in the moment, really kind of breaking it down. The only film I've seen that's really kind of trying to understand how the U.S. and China has approached this. But she's doing it all through her kind of personal lens of, like, experience. Really exciting film. And another one I'll call out tonight for anyone who's a little bit, you know, who loves our horror films. We have an incredible history in our midnight section of showcasing, you know, I think the great new directing talents in horror. And tonight, that film is Censor, the film at the festival this year. Censor. It's a first-time feature from a Welsh director named Prano Bailey Bond. And it's 1980s set horror film. And it is like we've played The Babadook or Hereditary, films that really broke out big. This is that movie this year. So anyone who wants to go a little bit darker, like, Censor is your movie.
Yeah. The next category always has some pleasant surprises. Anything there that stood out for you?
Yeah. I'm super excited about next. I think what I would call out in next this year is there's a film called Strawberry Mansion, which is a fun little, like, sweet throwback, but, like, visionary tale about a man in a weird dimension where he is a tax auditor, but how he audits people's taxes that they haven't paid is he goes into their memories, and he goes and visits their memories and kind of goes and tallies things that they never paid taxes on, and he falls for a woman and for old memories, and they kind of, like, fall for each other. Totally, totally unique kind of visual one. And another really cool one I'll call out is we've, over the past couple of years, we've played films like Search, that are films that all take place, really creative films that are designed to take place on computer screens. So you're watching through people's phones and social media accounts. So we have one this year called r#j, which is an update of the Romeo and Juliet story, but all told through the social media accounts of a group of young, you know, your characters. And so it's a really, really creative update of, like, the Romeo and Juliet story.
Okay. I kind of like to ask, I mean, which movie in this year's lineup would you consider the most difficult to explain? But it sounded like that Strawberry Mansion may be it. I don't know.
Yeah. There's another one in next, too, called, I'll talk a little bit, it's called Crypto Zoo. And this is an animated film. We don't get to play a lot of independently made animated films because they're incredibly difficult to make. But this filmmaker, his name is Dash Shaw. They're based in Virginia. He and his wife make handmade animated films all by themselves. It's unheard of. It does not exist anywhere. I've never seen, and he's the only one who does this. And so he's got this incredibly exciting, like, visual film. It's all about mythical creatures. And it's an adventure tale based on mythical creatures that basically Dash and his wife created themselves. It's totally, totally, like, unheard of in, like, cinema.
All right. And then last couple minutes here, we do have kind of the Townie Tuesday, but it's an opportunity for people to see one free screening, and it's the A Day in the Life.
Oh, great. Life in a Day.
Life in a Day. Thank you.
Yeah. So we did this a number of years ago. The filmmaker, Kevin McDonald, great documentarian, Kevin McDonald, asked people to all within a day across the world, just submit footage of that day. And he took thousands and thousands of hours and edited it together. And just to show you the experience of the world in a day. And so he decided within COVID and everything that he wanted to do that again. And so in July, they sent out to the world, like, if you want to take part, shoot your day, shoot something in your day and submit it. They do it in conjunction with YouTube. And so, it is this it's just this beautifully connected piece of just, like, the world and the experience of the world, how the world is dealing with COVID on a single day, and it shows you everything that you can see in life in a day, and it is just like a masterclass in editing. And so it's just a collection of all these experiences just masterfully edited together in a really, really, really moving piece.
Okay, so do you have the details then on how people can see that?
I personally, I'm sorry, I do not.
That's okay. That's okay. Hey, in just the last minute here, anything else that you wanted to say about this year's festival, given it's just different?
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like it's, I feel like just my few minutes I get to talk to the Park City of Park City, which is usually, I get 10 days of doing that. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great pleasure. You know, I feel like I've spent the past few months seeing people on social media, critics, industry, talking to people on the phones, and everyone, first thing they do is they list off how difficult it is to attend Sundance every year, and then they end it by saying, man, I wish I could be back to do that again. So I feel like everyone, we're really proud of what we've created this year and how this festival experience is going to be. Everyone seems so sadly to be missing not being there in Park City and being there with you guys. So we're with you guys in spirit, and we can't wait to be back together in person and very soon.
All right, Charlie, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Charlie Sexter, one of the programmers for the Sundance Film Festival. Again, you can find out lots more by going to festival.sundance.org. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.